Japan's inflation hit 3.7% in November, the highest since 1981, fueled by higher energy costs. A U.S. congressional panel probing the January 2021 attack on the Capitol releases its final report detailing why former President Donald Trump should face criminal charges. Also in the headlines, a deep freeze coupled with a massive winter storm hits the U.S. Midwest, leaving two-thirds of the nation under extreme weather alerts.
Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News.
Our top story, Japan is feeling the pinch of skyrocketing energy costs as official data shows prices of essential commodities rose at their fastest pace last month. According to data released by the Interior Ministry, core consumer prices climbed 3.7% in November compared to the previous year. The rise in prices for processed food items as well as electricity and durable goods has been the highest in the last four decades. The Japanese central bank, unlike Western economies, has not yet hiked interest rates to tackle soaring inflation, which have driven down the value of the yen against the dollar. The bank says it sees the recent price increases as temporary, and that there is no reason to change course yet. The surge in food and energy prices around the globe has been largely attributed to the ongoing war in Ukraine, as well as the West's standoff with Russia. And further news of stock markets volatility. Asian shares have plunged after Wall Street witnessed losses fueled by expectations that the Federal Reserve will lift the benchmark lending rate well into next year. Tokyo stocks opened lower on Friday, with the Nikkei index shedding over 1%. Stocks in Hong Kong, Shanghai and Seoul slipped as well. The drops came on the heels of jittery in Wall Street, where three main indexes ended well in the red on Thursday. Investors in global markets were seen nervous over earnings fluctuations and credit risks this month. Meanwhile, the Bank of Japan has decided to move away from its ultra-loose monetary policy. Other major central banks are also likely to raise interest rates higher than expected. Japan's decision to boost its military spending has drawn strong rebukes from civic leaders in South Korea. Tokyo argues its move to build up its forces comes amid threats from North Korea and China. Tokyo's arms purchases will also provide a boon for U.S. weapons producers. Frank Smith has a report from Seoul.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counter-attack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China.
Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex.
Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Turning elsewhere now, a U.S. congressional panel probing the 2021 attack on the Capitol building has released its final report. It accuses former President Donald Trump of inciting the deadly riots and engaging in a conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election results. The 800-page report is based on more than 1,000 interviews and hundreds of thousands of documents, as well as federal and state court rulings. The report indicates the former president knew he had lost the election, but still pressured officials, as well as his deputy, against the vote outcome. He then directly summoned what the committee calls a violent mob and refused to ask his supporters to leave. The report has been made public just days after the panel asked the Justice Department to charge Trump for four crimes, including obstruction and insurrection. It is the first time Congress has referred a former president to criminal prosecution in U.S. history. Trump has dismissed the committee and its report as a political witch hunt. Now, an investigation based on Twitter's internal files has revealed that the social media platform helped the U.S. military amplify its online propaganda campaigns about its activities in West Asia. The probe says Twitter granted Pentagon-affiliated accounts more visibility, even allowing fake accounts to push pro-U.S. narratives. At the top of the campaign's agenda was spreading criticism of Iran and showing support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
An investigation has shed light on the complicity of social media giant Twitter in the propaganda of the U.S. military in the West Asia region. The investigation says Twitter helped the U.S. military amplify its propaganda campaigns in this region, allowing fake accounts to push pro-U.S. narratives. The probe has been carried out by a journalist and is based on internal documents released by Elon Musk, who took over as Twitter's CEO in October. Musk has released the documents as an effort to boost transparency about the social media platform's operations under the previous management. The investigation says Twitter secretly created a special whitelist exempting accounts run by U.S. Central Command or CENTCOM for spam and abuse flags. The move allowed those accounts greater visibility on the platform. It says Twitter quietly introduced the feature in 2017. The measure was introduced after U.S. military officials asked the company to improve the visibility of Arab language accounts used to amplify certain messages. Those included promoting U.S. military narratives, anti-Iran messages, and support for the U.S. and Saudi-backed war in Yemen. According to the report, CENTCOM concealed its ownership of the accounts. In some cases, it used fake pictures and bios to give them the impression that they were run by civilians in the region. The social media giant tolerated the presence of the accounts on the platform until at least May 2022.
Now, the investigation says the collusion between Twitter and the U.S. military continued until at least May of this year. Twitter has long pledged to shut down all state-backed disinformation and propaganda campaigns. For example, in 2018, Twitter suspended accounts that were allegedly linked to Russia, but these rules and suspensions have not been applied to the American military.
Twitter has long pledged to shut down all state-backed disinformation and propaganda efforts. For example, in 2018, Twitter suspended accounts that were allegedly linked to Russia's propaganda efforts. But these rules and suspensions have not been applied to the American military efforts.
And the story also looks at the kind of hypocritical promises and pledges by Twitter. Twitter, since 2016, has promised to crack down on state-backed influence operations to shut down covert propaganda, and they brag all the time about shutting down Russian or Venezuelan or even Thai secret Twitter accounts that are run by the military.
Azerbaijan.
Yeah, Azeris are always doing this as well.
Yeah.
But really, the U.S. is doing this. And Twitter, even though they promised to shut down all state-backed influence operations, they've worked hand in glove with the U.S. military, giving them special privileges for their fake Twitter accounts, these fake personalities that kind of make organic-looking conversations in Yemen or Syria or Iraq.
The finding of this research appeared to corroborate a major report published in August by online security researchers affiliated with the Stanford Internet Observatory. That report claimed that thousands of accounts that they suspected to be part of a state-backed information operation. It said many of those accounts used photorealistic human faces generated by artificial intelligence and were connected with an online ecosystem that included fake news websites, meme accounts on Telegram and Facebook, and online personalities. They all echoed Pentagon messages and included anti-Iran messages. Some of them accused Iran of threatening Iraq's water security. Others promoted allegations that Iran was harvesting the organs of Afghan refugees. In the summer of 2020, officials from Facebook reportedly identified fake accounts attributed to CENTCOM's influence operation on its platform. Reports show in 2020, Facebook and Twitter executives were invited by the Pentagon's top attorneys to attend classified briefings in a sensitive, compartmented information facility. The result of that meeting was that many of the fake accounts remained active for at least another year. Some of the accounts on the CENTCOM list remain active even now.
And in the U.S., a deep freeze coupled with a massive winter storm hits the Midwest, leaving two-thirds of the nation under extreme weather alerts. The National Weather Service says the storm has affected more than 200 million people as the country is heading into the Christmas holiday weekend. Even President Joe Biden has described the condition as dangerous and threatening. The storm is forecast to develop into a, quote, bomb cyclone because of heavy snowfalls and chilling weather. Snow has blanketed areas stretching from the northern plains and the Great Lakes to the upper Mississippi Valley and western New York. It is expected to spread as far south as the U.S.-Mexico border. More than 5,000 flights scheduled for Thursday and Friday have also been cancelled, causing chaos among airbound travelers. Elsewhere, the de facto Taliban government has indefinitely suspended university education for all women in Afghanistan, the latest step in regression against the rights and freedoms of Afghan women. Rahmatullah Baghban has more from Kabul.
The Taliban officials on Tuesday ordered a nationwide ban on university education for Afghan women. Earlier, a letter made public by the spokesman for the Ministry of Higher Education, Ziaullah Hashimi, outlining that the measure would take effect immediately in private and public universities. Today, the Taliban forces barred women from entering Kabul University.
This piece of news was really disappointing. Last night, when I was told that the Taliban have ordered girls to be excluded from universities, I couldn't eat or sleep. After so many efforts and attending several classes in hope of making a bright future, they at once ruined everything. This order is very painful and unacceptable. It has to be reversed.
This was very shocking. Nowadays, we have been sitting our final test. Today, despite knowing that they wouldn't let us in, I rushed to the university. This is very difficult for an Afghan girl to comprehend the weight of being barred from getting education. So far, I've been worrying for my sisters who are banned from schools, and from now on, I should be concerned about my future too.
Afghan experts warn that the new order will have a devastating impact on the future of women as well as the entire Afghan nation. They urge the Taliban authorities to stop rolling back Afghan women's rights.
It is a catastrophic decision to ban women from universities. This can also be seen as a terrifying shock for Afghan society, especially the youth and women. It is so bitter and concerning. Previously, the explosion hit our girl students in tuition centers, but this devastating order is targeting the progress of a whole nation. The effects and consequences of this illogical order are unfortunate and irreparable in different arenas.
It's difficult to imagine how a country can...
In addition to oppositions from inside Afghanistan, the United Nations and several countries have condemned the order. They have signaled that the Taliban administration won't get recognition until they equally observe the human rights of all Afghans. After taking power, the Taliban promised a softer role and upholding women's rights. But today, many here say that the Taliban have been failing to abide by their promises. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Staying in the region, Pakistan's parliament has summoned the MPs belonging to the former Prime Minister's PTI party in person for the confirmation of their resignations. The lawmakers, however, have not appeared before the custodian of the National Assembly to tender their final resignation.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا
دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
كتاب الله.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to our latest episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Last week, we started explanation of Surah Saf, which was revealed in Medina and declares God's love of all those believers who maintain the solid ranks or unity in selflessly and fearlessly defending Islam. It encourages the believers to stick together in support of God's cause and criticizes those who broke their word and those who argued against the faith. Moses and Jesus are among the prophets whose communities became fragmented. The rebellious were left to go astray, and the faithful granted success. We continue from where we left you a fortnight ago, and here is Ayah 5.
وَإِذْ قَالَ مُوسَى لِقَوْمِهِ يَا قَوْمِ لِمَ تُؤْذُونَنِي وَقَدْ تَعْلَمُونَ أَنِّي رَسُولُ اللَّهِ إِلَيْكُمْ فَلَمَّا زَاغُوا أَزَاغَ اللَّهُ قُلُوبَهُمْ وَاللَّهُ لَا يَهْدِي الْقَوْمَ الْفَاسِقِينَ
When Moses said to his people, O my people, why do you torment me? When you certainly know that I am Allah's messenger to you? So when they swerved from the right path, Allah left their hearts to swerve, and Allah does not guide the transgressing lot. This ayah is a reference to the troubles given by the Israelites to Prophet Moses, despite the favors of God Almighty to them. They annoyed him to such an extent that they ridiculed the miracles he performed as magic and accused him of forging lies, despite the fact that they were certain of his mission as the prophet of God. The Israelites deviated from the straight path, and because of the extent of their evil deeds, the All-Merciful Lord left them to drift away from the path of truth. Thus, there is no affliction worse than deprivation of divine justice and the hardening of the heart to drift away from the path of truth. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one. Familiarity with the accounts of the prophets makes us firm-footed on the path of God and inspires us to resist against hardships. Number two, The Israelites were ungrateful to the favors of God and disobeyed the prophets, including Prophet Moses, who delivered them from the tyranny of the Pharaoh. They thus deprived themselves of divine guidance. Now listen to Ayah 6 of the same surah.
وَإِذْ قَالَ عِيسَى ابْنُ مَرْيَمَ يَا بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلَ إِنِّي رَسُولُ اللَّهِ إِلَيْكُمْ مُصَدِّقًا لِمَا بَيْنَ يَدَيَّ مِنَ التَّوْرَاةِ وَمُبَشِّرًا بِرَسُولٍ يَأْتِي مِنْ بَعْدِ اسْمُهُ أَحْمَدُ فَلَمَّا جَاءَهُم بِالْبَيِّنَاتِ قَالُوا هَذَا سِحْرٌ مُبِينٌ
And when Jesus, son of Mary, said, O children of Israel, indeed I am the messenger of Allah to you, to confirm what is before me of the Torah, and to give the good news of a messenger who will come after me, whose name is Ahmad. But when he brought them manifest proofs, they said, This is the plain magic. This ayah points to the message of Prophet Jesus, who conferred to the Israelites the teachings of Prophet Moses and gave the good news to them of the coming of the last and greatest messenger of God, that is Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The name Ahmad mentioned in this ayah means praiseworthy. And despite the interpolation of the evangel, this prophecy of Prophet Jesus of the coming of the last prophet is preserved. This is evident by the word comforter used for Ahmad in the English translation of the Gospel of St. John, which says in verse 16 of chapter 14, He will give you another to be your comforter, who will be with you for the ever, the spirit of truth. In verse 13 of chapter 16 of the same gospel, Jesus also says of the prophet to come after him, However, when he comes who is the spirit of truth, he will guide into all the truth. He will not speak on his own authority, but will tell only what he hears. And he will make known to you the things that are coming. Prophet Jesus performed miracles like raising the dead, curing the blind, molding birds out of clay, and infusing life into them by the command of the Almighty Creator. But the ever rebellious Israelites rejected these miracles as magic. Along with the pagan Arabs, they also ridiculed the miracles performed by the Prophet of Islam as magic. From this ayah we learn that, number one, every prophet used to confirm the mission of the past prophets and give tidings of the prophets to come after. Number two, Prophet Jesus has explicitly announced the universal mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Number three, the prophecies of Jesus regarding Islam are all too evident in the Bible, despite the interpolation. And number four, the deniers of truth ridicule miracles as magic. Present you ayahs 7, 8, and 9 of Surah Saf in conclusion of this week's episode.
وَمَنْ أَظْلَمُ مِمَّنِ افْتَرَى عَلَى اللَّهِ الْكَذِبَ وَهُوَ يُدْعَى إِلَى الْإِسْلَامِ وَاللَّهُ لَا يَهْدِي الْقَوْمَ الظَّالِمِينَ يُرِيدُونَ لِيُطْفِئُوا نُورَ اللَّهِ بِأَفْوَاهِهِمْ وَاللَّهُ مُتِمُّ نُورِهِ وَلَوْ كَرِهَ الْكَافِرُونَ هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
And who is a greater wrongdoer than him who fabricates falsehoods against Allah while he is being summoned to Islam? And Allah does not guide the wrongdoing lots. They desire to put out the light of Allah with their mouths, but Allah will perfect His light, though the faithless should be averse. It is He who has sent His Prophet with the guidance and the religion of truth, that He may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheist should be averse. These ayahs are reference to those evil persons who, when invited to the path of truth, resort to blasphemy, even against the Almighty Creator, and as a result are left by God to go astray. Allah sends His guidance freely, but withdraws His grace from those who willfully indulge in falsehood and debasing superstitions in opposition to the light of eternal unity and harmony, which is Islam. The divine light of guidance enlightens the seekers of truth in all times. It is a continuous process. It is inextinguishable, despite the gravity of the plots of the disbelievers to try to snuff it out. The Islamic doctrines are steadily gaining ground all over the world through promotion of the concept of justice, harmony, fraternity, human rights, and the real freedom for women, free from exploitation by men. Thus, to aversion of the disbelievers, the light of guidance of Islam, its progress towards ultimate triumph over all other religions, will illuminate the whole world with the advent in the end times of the Prophet's 12th and last infallible heir, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, who will end corruption on earth and establish the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, it is a cardinal sin to ascribe lies to Almighty Creator and His prophets. Number two, the genuine teachings of Islam are light since they're enlighten hearts, minds, and souls. Number three, the enemies of humanity have always tried to put out the light of guidance through every means, but have miserably failed. Number four, Islam is the universal religion and will eventually prevail over all creeds and schools of thought. And number four, God Almighty, who sent prophets for the guidance of human beings, has promised the eventual triumph of Islam, even if the disbelievers are averse, with the reappearance of Imam Mahdi and his global government of peace, prosperity, and justice.
This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Last week, Peru's President Pedro Castillo was removed from office. His charge, quote, rebellion, which came after he announced that he would shut down Congress. Enter Castillo's Vice President Dina Boluarte, who was sworn in as the new president, becoming the first female head of state in Peru's history. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what has happened in Peru and whether the U.S., who has shown support for the coup and the new president, had any role in it. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Arnold August joins us. He's an author and journalist from Montreal. Also joining us is Libra Sankar, who's a contributor at the Troika Collective, joining us from Miami.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Libra Sankar, I'll start with you. If you can please tell us, in so many words, what has happened in Peru? What did Pedro Castillo do to be dealt the harsh hand that he has been dealt with at this point?
So what we have happening in Peru is not anything new to the history. Peruvian politics have unfortunately developed into what is happening today. So what happens? Pedro Castillo represents the indigenous community. He comes from a working class background. And he represents a move towards a Peru that acknowledges the role of working class people, of indigenous people. And so he poses a threat to the working class, or he poses a threat to the far right, people that come from like Fujimori and the Fujimoristas. He also was pushing for a new constitution, which is one of the platforms that he ran on and got high approval for. And so Pedro Castillo represents what the far right fears, which is Peru moving towards a working class politic that benefits the working class people of Peru and the indigenous people of Peru. And this is a very scary thing, which is why a coup has been orchestrated. What Pedro Castillo was pushing for in dissolving Congress is nothing new. In fact, the president prior to him did it, and many other presidents have done it. It's part of their constitution that a president can dissolve Congress if they feel they're not able to move forward. And so Pedro Castillo, unfortunately, is part of a larger plan to continue destabilizing Peru so that U.S. corporations and people like the U.S. ambassador can continue to take advantage of the of Peru as a mineral-rich country and a country that is full of working-class people.
Okay, very good. We're going to get to some of those points a little later, but first, trying to understand how Peru has unraveled at the speed that it has, Arnold August. And our guests there mentioned something that is very key in this, and that is the fact that you know, this is not anything new, what Pedro Castillo did, which was in essence, to be more concrete here, it was Article 134 that is something that he enacted, which was only going to be a temporary closure from what we understand, in which the president said new congressional elections would then be held as soon as possible. So are we to take the fact that what was then done to him was part of, as our guest star mentioned, of a bigger plan to oust him?
Yes, of course. I'm quite sure right after he got elected, I'm sure that the United States and their allies in Europe and Canada started to go into action in order to plan what we call lawfare, that is using juridical or so-called legal means to overthrow the elected president. And, you know, we just discussed, you know, the question of the United States' role. I mean, the day before his arrest and the coup took place, the day before, the American embassy in Peru actually met with the opposition. So they are directly involved in that. And I think that the fact that he dissolved the Congress, I perfectly believe it is a correct decision, while some, you know, middle of the roaders are saying, well, we oppose what happened to him, but the fact that he dissolved the Congress was not right. It was right, because right now, who has the last word on this? It should be the people in the streets. And the people in the streets in Peru right now are calling for a constituent assembly. That is to replace that Congress. So that decision was right, I think, legally, morally, and also historically, because it opens up a new path for the people in the street. And we saw, when we discussed these type of governments before at Press TV, I always presented the position that we cannot, you know, whether it's the left, part of the left tide or not, I always was always of the opinion we cannot concentrate on the personalities who won elections, for example, Boric in Chile, and now Castillo in Peru. What we have to look at is the larger picture. Where did Castillo come from? He came from a mass movement of indigenous workers. He himself is a teacher. And that what brought him into power. And that is why on the ground now, that you were talking about the left, the pink tide. The pink tide in Peru is happening right now.
Indeed. Well, tell us your reaction, if you can, Libra Sankar, to the a move that the VP, Dina Boluarte, made and then became the president, where she accused the president of, I don't want to call him the former president, but it appears that way for now, Castillo, of a coup attempt. And then basically it just happened a few hours later from what we understand, where she became the president. She was sworn in. I mean, why would she be the one chosen for this, do you think? And at this point, obviously, we're seeing the backlash on the streets. So is that a miscalculation on the part of the grand scheme of things?
I think what we have is betrayal. The ambassador of the U.S. met with Dina Boluarte, the so-called president of Peru. And given the trajectory of Peruvian politics, it's also highly unlikely that she herself is going to last until the 2026 elections. And again, Pedro Castillo is the only democratically elected president. The people did not elect Dina Boluarte to lead them. And I think this speaks to the move and the direction that Peru was trying to go into. The comrade just spoke about pink tide. And I think what we see happening in Latin America right now is the U.S. trying to impose unipolarity. And we see pink tide 2.0 coup and coup attempts. This is happening in Peru. They're using lawfare in Argentina, and they're trying to do another coup in Bolivia. And all these happen to be countries that are moving further to the left. So Dina Boluarte is just a pawn in the larger grand scheme of the U.S. trying to maintain its exploitative relationship to countries like Peru, that if they are to develop for the Peruvian masses of people, the indigenous Peruvians, the working class Peruvians, that Peru could in fact stand on its own two feet and not have to be dependent on the U.S. In this very parasitic exploitative relationship. And Europe is just as guilty in this as well.
How is Europe guilty?
Europe is guilty because they're playing more of the corporate side of things. Their corporations, the mining, are all corporations that are in Europe, and as well as the U.S. It's kind of like a joint venture.
So many people have referred to the EU being a vassal state of the U.S. Let's look into the situation more with the U.S. interference, Arnold August, as both of you have indicated that that occurred. Now, Arnold August, you said that just a day earlier, before this went down, you had the U.S. ambassador meet with the opposition. We also understand that a day before, U.S. ambassador, who is a former CIA agent, also met with, the defense minister, from what we understand, a retired brigadier general, which then, we understand, he ordered the military to turn against Castillo. So this is not something that has happened in a matter of just 24, 48 hours. As both of you have indicated, in a sense, this is a scheme, a plan that the U.S., in conjunction with different players within Peru's political apparatus, had planned before. Am I correct to look at it that way?
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. And you and our guest just mentioned the United States and other actors such as Europe. Allow me to point out to another actor that is much more vigorous in support of the coup than the Europeans, and that is Canada. You know, Canada is right from the start took the following position, saying they issued a one-sentence statement saying Canada would like to express its deep concern over Castillo's attempt to dissolve Congress and establish a government of exception in Peru. Such destabilizing actions risk jeopardizing Peru's adherence to democracy. And if that is not enough, another statement from Canada came out the day later. Canada calls for calm and invites all actors. That's a very famous line from Canada, all actors. When the revolt was taking place in Chile a couple of years ago, and it was obvious the use of the army and the Carabineros in actually killing and maiming people, they always call for all actors to avoid tensions and all that. Now, I cannot help myself to make the comparison. While the Trudeau government jumps right from start one, run from game one, the first day, in opposing the demonstrations of millions of people in Peru, indigenous workers, against the coup. In Iran, they support the U.S.-led riots that are taking place in Iran. So I think it's important for people to really have a good grasp of the dirty role that Canada plays through Justin Trudeau as the most faithful ally of U.S. imperialism, not only in Latin America, but internationally.
Sure. Well, they have played destructive roles when we go through the different actions that have been executed, with U.S. being in the lead in many of them. But before we get to that, let's look at some of the reactions, Libre Sankara, of Latin American leaders, because you have many of the governments. At last count, there were seven of them, where you have Mexico, Argentina, Bolivia, Colombia, Honduras, Venezuela, Cuba, and some other nations at this point who have criticized and refused to recognize Peru's unelected coup regime, as they have called it. Is that going to make a difference in the fate of Peru and where it's headed when you have this opposition of this magnitude?
I think what it symbolizes is a shift towards multipolarity, a shift away from U.S. Imperialism and its role in Latin America in general. I think things like this will become more frequent. I don't know that it will have tangible presence in Peru itself. I think the Peruvian people, the ronderos that come from these indigenous communities that helped to have this historical victory to elect Pedro Castillo as president, I think between them and Peru Libre and other left factions in Peru will ultimately play the most important roles. But I think what these statements help do is to to help the Peruvian people understand that they have the solidarity of other countries. I don't know that these countries are going to send any real firm resources to help help Peruvians fight against this. But I also see countries like Mexico trying to talk with the government to offer Pedro Castillo asylum. In fact, when he realized what was happening, he tried to go to the Mexican embassy, and he was barred from doing that by his security detail, and shortly after he was detained. And so we have to be very vigilant of what's going to continue to happen. Unfortunately, more Peruvians are going to be killed because, again, they democratically elected Pedro Castillo. They want him in office. They are going out into the streets, but this is being met by the far right that has no problem killing people, that has no problem harming its own citizens to maintain its own greedy benefit that these far-right Fujimorista type of people hope to continue. They want to continue being in positions of power and exploiting their own people and getting business deals. And so the seven countries, and I'm sure there will be more to follow, are simply showing their solidarity with the working class people. Hopefully that shows up in tangible ways. But as in the foreseeable future, it doesn't look like they're going to send any material things. This is symbolic, and it's helpful sure. to build morale, but that's about it.
Okay, well, Arnold August, our guest, also mentioned the pink tide, and we've seen what has happened in the past couple of years in terms of the political landscape that is characterized by the term pink tide, where you have these left-wing presidents to pretty much come into power because they are the ones that actually represent the true people out in the broad economy and society of the different countries that they represent. I mean, one of the most, prolific ones would be the Brazilian President Lula da Silva that came out in some sense, and him winning the presidency was very, was an eye-opener, I would guess, from the U.S. perspective, because he made one announcement, and that was how he wants there to be a move away from the dollar. He wants the local economies of each country to deal in their national currencies. Are we looking at this to have ticked off the U.S., this new wave of left-wing presidents, as they say, and therefore they are now counter-reacting to that?
Yes, I would say so. I just add, both of you rightly mentioned all of the presidents and leaders of the Latin American countries that took a firm stand publicly in support of Castillo. I would add one other book that just came out, I think, yesterday, and that is ALBA, which includes many countries, including in the small Caribbean island. In terms of the current situation, I think aside from what happened to Cristina Kirchner a couple of weeks ago, this attempt here is the first attempt of a coup since the election of Lula in Brazil. You know, I think that is going to make a big difference. Brazil, of course, as everyone knows, it's a major player in Latin America, and through BRICS, it has important ties with other important countries such as China, India, South Africa, and Russia. And the way China is now increasingly making its presence felt on the international scale with regards to other countries, for example, just a few days ago, making a clear statement in support of the right of Palestine to its own state with its capital in East Jerusalem. The United States might have some surprises, as not only the countries in Latin America that perhaps feel more confident, more bold since the election of Brazil, but even internationally, this may build up further, and it may be a very hard situation for the United States and its allies to face while Castillo is in prison, and everyone is against that in Peru and many countries of the world, not only in Latin America.
Okay. The fact that you came out right away pretty much, Libra Sankar, and talked about how you have Castillo that represents the indigenous population there in Peru, and the fact that he is the one that was able to edge out in the vote because he had the common people be on his side. Tell us the way that this has backfired for the ones that were in control of the major industries and how they felt threatened. And perhaps given the fact that they have connections, and I'm just making the connection here, and whether it's accurate or not is up for you to tell us. And that these, for example, we know that Castillo brought in a lot of new ministers. And I'm guessing just that fact itself might have threatened the livelihoods of some of these people who, I don't know if I want to call them oligarchs or not, but, you know, the ones that were in power in different sectors and fields of the economy. And therefore, they obviously sided with the motion to try to oust Castillo. And that's where the U.S. connection also comes in, because you have Peru that has a lot of important natural resources, gold being the number one, from what I understand, natural resource of Peru. Is that a correct reading into this?
Yeah, that is an accurate reading. And in fact, I mean, Peru, since the colonial times, has been taken advantage of by foreign interests. And so what Castillo represents is indigenous working class, right? Like, this is somebody that when they were giving speeches, they spoke in the indigenous language, which brought a lot of the elected officials to anger, because their status quo is to speak Spanish, to kind of take on this more, it's not educated to speak like that, and this demonization of indigenous people in a country that's mostly indigenous, they just until Pedro Castillo were not in positions of power. They weren't being appointed. Their perspectives were not being brought into policies. Their perspectives were not being brought into the proposed new constitution, which is something that has also been happening during the peak tide. A lot of these left governments have been rewriting their constitutions or codifying new laws. For example, Cuba just passed its family codes, and Chile, unfortunately, didn't vote, but they were looking to rewrite their own constitution. And so Pedro Castillo also represents and came from the Peru Libre Party, which, he appointed a Marxist-Leninist in his cabinet, which unfortunately the individual had to step down, because shortly after being put into his position, he got death threats. And this just shows how status quo the career politicians want to keep Peru. Again, Peru, with such rich economy and such access to resources, has been a country that has been overexploited and underdeveloped. And this works to the benefit of these career politicians and to foreign interests instead of the interests of Peruvians. And so Pedro Castillo represented and still represents a move towards a new type of Peru, a Peru that is moving left and closer to a Peru for Peruvians themselves. And so this scares people that don't want that to be the reality, because it doesn't benefit their pockets. Okay. And so that's why millions of Peruvians are out in the streets protecting and asking for his release.
Thank you for that. Arnold August, author and journalist from Montreal, a pleasure. And Libra Sankara, thank you. Contributor at the Troika Collective from Miami. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Batawe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.